This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
What is it good for?
Absolutely not.
Say it again.
That's The Temptations, 1970. What will the frivolous burst of masculine violence in the Middle East cost the future? Experts chronicle and warn us about the climate cost of modern war. Dr. Patrick Bigger, Research Director at the Climate and Community Institute, joins us. Then Netta Crawford, Co-Director of the Costs of War Project at Brown University, speaks. Netta's books include The Pentagon, Climate Change and War, Charting the Rise and Fall of U.S. Military Emissions. From a panel on Iran and climate hosted by well-known journalist and author Mark Hertzgard, we hear Giles Trendle, former managing director of Al Jazeera English and co-chair of CC Now. It's a full load for this climate emergency, getting hotter all the time. I'm Alex Smith. Let's go. Talk about your earth-shaking news. Science proves it. Significant acceleration of global warming since 2015. That comes from the respected Potsdam Institute in Germany. Earth is warming faster over the last 10 years than during any previous decade. No, it is not El Nino or volcanoes going off or changes to the sun. They figured all that. This is human war against the atmosphere ramping up along with nature's reactions, including destabilized weather. Scientists Grant Foster and Stefan Ramsdorf say, at the present rate, we will exceed the 1.5 degree C limit of the Paris Climate Accord by or before the year 2030. That used to be 2100, then it was 2050, and now it's less than 4 years away. All along, starting a decade ago, retired NASA scientist James Hansen warned the rate of climate change was accelerating. It was met with doubt, but I think that's gone now. In his latest post, Hansen predicts a terrible 2 degrees average global warming by or during the 2030s. With his small team, Hansen writes, quote, "The world seems headed into another El Nino just 3 years after the last one. Such quick return normally would imply, at most, an El Nino of moderate strength. But we suggest that even a moderately strong El Nino may yield record global temperatures already in 2026 and still greater temperature in 2027. The extreme warming will be the result mainly of high climate sensitivity and a recent increase of the net global climate forcing, not the result of an exceptional El Nino per se. We find that the principal drive for global warming acceleration began in about 2015, which implies that 2 degrees global warming is likely to be reached in the 2030s, not at mid-century," end quote from James Hansen and his team. He's still working on his new book, Sophie's Planet. He's 84 years old. As with The Guardian, March 6th, reporting the awful accelerating warming news, the new study found, quote, "Global heating accelerated from a steady rate of less than 0.2 degrees C per decade between 1970 and 2015 to about 0.35 C per decade over the last 10 years. The rate is higher than scientists have seen since they started systematically taking the Earth's temperature in 1880, end quote. We are already burning up the future. Can the shutdown of Gulf oil and gas help stem the tide of carbon into the atmosphere? What about all that jet fuel and rocket fuel torched in the war against Iran and now Lebanon? Add in demolition of Tehran and damage in the Gulf states, and the climate costs for reconstruction concrete are just not possible for a survivable world for humans. The whole crisis of blocking the Strait of Hormuz would be impossible with solar panels and wind distributed around the world. Unless electric utilities raise rates, electric vehicle owners won't feel the pain at the pumps with those rising gas and diesel prices. We could have ended dependence on Middle East energy a decade ago, but here we are. This crisis is rapidly spreading spinning out into a major recession, if not an economic crash. It is all coming from a long age of fossil dominance and fossil colonialism and violence. That is the history coming out of every gallon and liter, every piece of plastic, all the concrete and steel. Fossil fuels are violent.
Every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired signifies, in the final sense, a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and are not clothed.
That was Republican President and Second World War hero Dwight Eisenhower in 1953. Now we investigate the true climate costs of modern warfare, greenhouse gas emissions from military operations, supply chains, infrastructure, and reconstruction. You see it on TV and social media. Another refinery explodes, a concrete city blows up into rubble, flaming missiles and planes light up the atmosphere. In Russia, Ukraine, Gaza, and now Iran, humans are at war against the atmosphere. A whole new branch of climate science adds up the steep carbon cost. That includes Dr. Patrick Bigger. Patrick is research director at the Climate and Community Institute that's based in Philadelphia. He co-authored the report, Confronting Military Greenhouse Gas Emissions. Patrick Bigger, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you so much for having me.
According to a growing mountain of science, we're already pushing past dangerous climate boundaries, and there are a few weak rescue plans out there from global conferences. But talk to us, Patrick, about the military emissions gap.
We know that militaries are massive contributors to the climate crisis, none more so than the United States military, but other big militaries as well, Russia, China, militaries of the European Union. But for a long time, we have not known exactly how big of contributors they are. And a lot of that is down to the fact that going all the way back to the negotiations in Kyoto in the early 1990s, big governments, and especially the U.S., sought a carve-out for reporting their military emissions. The U.S. sought that kind of carve-out and got it, and so it's been up to external researchers to use whatever tools that they can sort of scrape together in order to try to identify military emissions. And so that's what a lot of the researchers have been up to for the last decade or so, trying to get a feel for how big of a contributor to the climate crisis that militarism and militaries and their associated industries are.
Yes, it's a daunting task. Could you start by introducing us to the broad categories of military emissions considered by your group of experts? What sort of things are you looking at?
The most challenging of all of these categories is to understand conflict emissions, just given how little transparency there is amongst combatants. So, for example, when we were trying to come up with an emissions figure for the genocide in Gaza, you have to rely on press reporting as to what kinds of bombs are being used, what kinds of flights are being taken, et cetera. And those numbers can be tough to pin down, but you know, we think we've done a pretty good job ascertaining the carbon bootprint of the genocide in Gaza. But those military operations are only, you know, those combat operations are only a small piece of the military carbon bootprint. The everyday sort of operations actually have a much bigger climate impact. So Nia Crawford and her team at the Cost of War Project, you know, estimated that even at the height of the Iraq War, about 80% of U.S. military greenhouse gas emissions came from just kind of everyday operations. And chief amongst those are the flights associated with military operations. So that's training flights, that's moving people to and fro across the U.S.'s global empire of 800 overseas military bases, that's procuring food and fuel and munitions, so forth, and moving them around. So, you know, as a result, the Air Force actually has by far the highest carbon footprint of any of the armed forces in the U.S. But then there's a range of other things. You know, if you think about a $1 trillion budget and how much just stuff that buys, and all the emissions associated with it. So we can think about the electricity to power bases. We can think about the manufacturing of things like, you know, Mark 84 bombs that were dropped on civilians in Gaza, or think about the variants, other kinds of aircraft, you know, the F-35, and just in the production of these things and how much aluminum and how much critical minerals go into that. There's just massive environmental implications for running such a giant military-industrial complex.
You know, it may seem strange, but there's another detail about these wars that's been really bothering me, and that's about concrete. I mean, even in peacetime, cement and concrete are responsible for about 8% of global greenhouse gas emissions. It's huge. It's like that industry alone is the third largest emitter behind China and the U.S. We have to carefully limit concrete use, but then humans blow up entire cities from Gaza to Ukraine and now likely Tehran. Talk to us about the concrete problem in these wars.
Yeah, that's right, Alex. There's a number of ways that militaries sort of interface with concrete as an emitting category. One of the ways is the way that you mentioned in terms of stuff that gets blown up needs to be rebuilt. When we were doing our estimate of the climate costs of the genocide in Gaza, we found that the vast majority of emissions in the long term come from rebuilding Gaza, even to its previously sort of insufficient state, that takes, you know, the emissions from the conflict from, you know, measurable but maybe not globally significant up to emissions on par with entire major industrial countries like Czechia. But then there's also, you know, in terms of military operations itself, you have to think about the volume of concrete that was used, for example, by the U.S. in securing Baghdad during the occupation of Iraq for 20 years. My colleague Benjamin Nymark at Queen Mary University led research on this, demonstrating just the unbelievable volume of concrete that was poured into these, you know, blast-proof walls dividing up the city. And then we can also think about the concrete that is going to be necessary to protect existing military assets from the climate crisis that the military itself has been a major contributor to. So if we think about, you know, the world's largest naval installation is at Hampton Roads, Virginia, which is an area facing a tremendous amount of sea level rise. And so as a result, you're going to have to pour tons and tons and tons of concrete to building seawalls to protect those installations, right? And so you kind of get into this this feedback loop where more warming generates more environmental impacts, which requires more concrete to mitigate. And if you're the military, you have effectively unlimited resources to do so, and so you do.
You're part of an international group of experts, including from Queen Mary University of London and your own climate and community project. And you did a case study on Gaza. Tell us what you found in your 2025 study of greenhouse gas emissions of the Israel-Gaza conflict.
All right, yeah. So we started tracking the emissions of Israel's attack on Gaza following the horrific attacks of October 7th, 2023. Over the winter of 2024 and continuing on for 180 days after that, and we actually have updated numbers that are coming out in a peer-reviewed journal soon. But what we found was that the projected emissions from 15 months of the direct war activities, so that is, the bombing runs of the supply flights of the sort of the war fighting actions taken by Israel and its allies, especially the United States, those emissions were greater than the annual emissions of 36 individual countries and territories, many of which are small emitters, but are also the most vulnerable countries to the effects of the climate crisis. You know, the small island developing states of the Pacific, the Tuvalus and Fijis of the world, who have done virtually nothing to contribute to the climate crisis, but are bearing the brunt of its effects already. But then when we expand out and look at all the other activities associated with these attacks, so including the creation of Israel's protective iron wall, thinking about also Hamas's tunnel network, then emissions go up to more than 41 of the lowest emitting countries and territories. But then you get into the really big emissions that come out of reconstructing Gaza and the homes destroyed in Lebanon. And then you get to emissions on par with entire, you know, European countries.
So news coverage and social media just love to show big missiles blasting up into the atmosphere. Are they adding to climate change for all of us?
Very much so. I mean, I think in the initial reporting on the emissions figures that we did, one of the a former UN special rapporteur had a very pithy quote that I couldn't agree with more, that, you know, in the context of a rapidly dwindling carbon budget, war and genocide in particular are an incredibly stupid way to spend up that budget. And that's precisely what we're seeing in these wars of choice, you know, that Trump has just launched in Venezuela and now in Iran. And so every time one of these missiles goes up, you know, it's obviously burning propellant in the atmosphere contributes to the climate crisis. But we have to think about the entire supply chain emissions of how those missiles came to be. So we think about the mining to dig up the aluminum and all the rare earth minerals that go into the guidance systems. We have to think about the energy involved in getting those materials, refining those materials, and then getting them to the production facility, of producing themselves, of shipping them to wherever they're going to be launched from, and then the damage that they cause on the back end. So every time we see a Hellfire missile or a Mark 84 bomb dropped, and think about not just the emissions that are visible in that specific moment of time, but the full life cycle emissions of these weapons, and you know, just how fundamentally avoidable those environmental impacts are.
I was surprised to learn in this war that military aviation releases even more greenhouse gases than missiles and interceptors. And then I started digging into things, and here's one factoid. The U.S. Air Force has almost 500 refueling tankers, and the largest U.S. Air Force refueling tanker, the KC-10 Extender, it carries 52,000 gallons of military fuel. That's a jet propellant special mix. And it's burning that whole load into the atmosphere, creates over 1 million pounds of CO2 or 500 metric tons. So there's a whole fossil fuel network now in the sky, like filling stations flying around.
I talked about a little bit at the beginning of our call, and I think it's really important to understand how much the everyday operations of militaries are contributing to the climate crisis, and that's primarily through the use, you know, burning of jet fuel. And jet fuel is important because it is sort of uniquely climate damaging when you burn these fuels at high altitude, right? It interacts with the chemistry of the atmosphere differently and creates more warming effects, especially the release of water vapor at high atmosphere. And there's just an insatiable need for it, and there's really no conceivable path to mitigating those emissions anytime soon through any mechanism other than just simply reducing the amount of time that military aircraft are flown, right? There is no plausible path to sustainable aviation fuel or to, you know, replace some of that jet fuel with batteries or whatever. The only solution there is to cut the amount of time that these aircraft spend in the air. And by extension, the way you do that is by reducing the amount of funding that is available for flying those aircraft.
As we speak, the airspace over Iran is almost empty. Commercial flights to and from the Middle East have more or less stopped. Is it possible this pause in commercial flights will lead to short reductions in aviation emissions, even if we include those military flights?
I guess it's hypothetically possible. I mean, I'm not sure how many total air trips that are going to be reduced by this closure of airspace, how much of that travel simply be rerouted. I'd be much more concerned about the long-run implications of, you know, what is happening with the closure of the Strait of Hormuz and the export of fossil fuels from Iran, from Qatar, from all the other countries that export through that very narrow strip of sea lane, you know, that are going to create probably short-term reductions in the amount of energy of fossil fuels that are exported, but in the long run are going to create windfall profits for fossil fuel firms as the price of oil goes up. And that's important because this is precisely what happened after Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine in 2022, when fossil fuel firms made record profits and then were able to, on the one hand, return those as dividends to shareholders, who are disproportionately the very wealthy, who have the highest per capita carbon footprints in the world, but more importantly, plow a lot of that money back into exploration and production of new fossil fuels, which once you've invested that money, it's, you know, in the absence of rigorous climate regulation, it's very hard to see those fuels being left in the ground, right? And so even if there is a short-term reduction in emissions from air travel or from rising costs, which of course disproportionately impact the working class, both in the global north and the global south, you know, even if there is a short-term reduction in those emissions, in the long term, this is actually very bad for the sort of scaling up of the fossil fuel industry.
Yeah, you know, I kind of compare military emissions. It might be like volcanic explosions. At first, the volcanic dust cools the surface with shade, but that only lasts a year or so. And then all the greenhouse gases that were also blasted up with the volcano remain up there for 100,000 years, adding to the heat. So we, as you say, might see a short reduction and then another burst. Look, some of the tools used to analyze the real climate costs of war were established in 2024 by Leonard de Klerk and of course, other colleagues. And the initiative on GHG accounting of war, I wanted to mention that group, that network was established to assess greenhouse gas damages from the Russian invasion of Ukraine, but now it has to keep going with new conflicts. So, Patrick, it's way too early to judge the climate impact of this Iran war, but what are your early indicators? Do you think this could top Gaza or Ukraine for outright climate harm?
I think it most certainly could, because I don't think we have any vague idea of what the end state of this illegal, immoral, disastrously ill-conceived war on Iran is. Right, the administration has made it perfectly clear that they don't know what the end goal is. They've just destabilized a massive country with a lot of internal divisions that are poorly understood by this government that really could result in regional instability for years, if not decades, and cost countless lives and tens, if not hundreds of billions of dollars. And so there's no way of knowing exactly how badly out of control this will spiral. And so I think if we are looking at what the long-term climate consequences will be, I think, we're more likely to see something on par with the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003 than the genocide in Gaza.
Well, as you say, military emissions are not reported, and somehow the carbon cost of war is just magically left out. Is there any move to get real about the defense emissions? Should the public know?
I think we absolutely need to know. And there are a lot of folks, very smart folks, very dedicated folks, working on this, both within the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change sort of arena and externally. As you said, there have been some really amazing methodological innovations in the space led by folks like Leonard de Klerk. I think for me personally, tallying the climate impacts of war and militarism are important because we need to have a full idea of just how quickly we are polluting our climate and sort of lurching towards these unpredictable tipping points. But on the other hand, I think that we don't need to know precisely what these emissions are to know that they are bad, to know that they are dangerous, and to know that they are avoidable. So obviously, more data is better than less, but at the same time, we can't let the absence of perfect data be an impediment to us pushing for the reduction in military emissions through, a more just, more sane foreign policy that doesn't hinge on these new wars popping up every 6 months or year.
I'm kind of a give peace a chance person. Patrick, do you find it disturbing to catalog the carbon trail of war after war?
I find it very challenging to think about all of the myriad avoidable ways that humans and that the powerful are exacerbating the climate crisis on a daily basis. I find it most depressing to think about the human consequences. The molecules are a way of sort of tracking what's going on. I don't concern myself with the molecules. So I don't worry about them as much as I worry about the people who are going to be suffering immediately as a result of these disastrous military interventions. and the folks who are going to suffer, who are disproportionately working class people in the U.S., in the global north, across the world, the working class people who will suffer the impacts of the climate crisis and of the economic blowback from these kinds of ill-conceived foreign policy interventions. So, yeah, I'm worried about it, but I'm worried about it in a broader suite of the human suffering that these very poorly conceived military interventions are creating.
From the Climate and Community Institute, we've been speaking with Interim Executive Director and researcher Patrick Bigger. Find all kinds of links to news and reports on war and climate in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Patrick, thank you for your work and for talking with us today.
Thank you so much for having me, and hopefully we can talk again under more peaceful circumstances.
You bet. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. ecoshock.org.
Netta Crawford is a leading expert in U.S. military emissions. She is one of the few to ever tally that up. Netta is co-director of the Costs of War Project at Brown University. She's also a professor at the University of Oxford. In 2022, Netta published The Pentagon, Climate Change, and War, charting the rise and fall of U.S. military emissions.
From the beginning of the use of fossil fuels, they've been tightly associated with, first of all, the need for bases if you want to have global power projection, and of course, the need for a secure supply to the fuel. Then if you want to hurt the other side, of course, then you would engage in an embargo. And here we see an image, a cartoon of the oil embargo that the U.S. began against the Japanese in 1941. And then lots of attacks on oil refineries were also part of the World War II strategy. This continues the attacks on oil refineries in the Iraq War. Of course, the Iraqis set Kuwaiti oil fields on fire. And then the U.S. has also attacked Iraqi oil fields more recently. We'll talk a little bit more about that as we go on. Now, part two, what are the current emissions? Well, unsurprisingly, because the United States is engaged in a global war on terror and also has legacy forces and current missions and future missions projected all over the world, it has a global infrastructure to, like the British before us, to make sure that we have access to the capacity to move and project power. So this is the infrastructure of the war on terror. And the Defense Logistics Agency is responsible for securing all the fuel that's necessary for that. They're located in 20 states and 8 countries. They have many distribution centers, and they supply fuel to the different services. In the context of U.S. energy consumption, as you can see from this, the DOD is the U.S. government's largest energy consumer. In fact, it's so dominant that, as you can see, the total fuel use, energy consumption by the U.S. tracks the DOD. When the DOD goes up, total U.S. use goes up and goes down. It's correlated. And this shows basically what the fuel is used for. Most of it, the dominant portion of it is jet fuel, then diesel, and then there's some electrical energy consumption. But it's mostly vehicles and equipment.
Crawford's slide shows examples of U.S. military aircraft jet fuel consumption and the carbon dioxide equivalent emissions. The B-2 bomber, 4.28 gallons a mile, 10 liters per kilometer. Burning one load of that plane's 25,000 gallons without refueling results in 251 metric tons of carbon dioxide equivalent. The KC-46A refueling tanker holds 16,000 gallons of fuel for its own use, and a full load of just burning its own fuel, don't count the tanker fuel, is about 156 metric tons of carbon dioxide equivalent. The worst plane on Netta's slide is the KC-135R, which burns 4.9 gallons per mile.
And here's the DOD fuel consumption. This is my calculation. Again, jet fuel is dominant. So if you think back to that previous slide where U.S. consumption correlates with DoD consumption. It's really correlating largely with jet fuel consumption. So here we see the Defense Logistics Agency's purchases of millions of barrels of oil from 1998 to 2018. Again, jet fuel is dominant, but diesel is quite important. So jet fuel, obviously, for aircraft, but diesel for ships and also for vehicles that are on the surface. And what that tells you is that operations and transportation is most important, and the facilities are clearly important as well, but not as important.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Netta shows a slide showing the Department of Defense fuel consumption from 1975 to 2018. In that period, she calculates the U.S. military burned more than 184 billion gallons, almost 700 billion liters of high-carbon jet fuel, along with 38 billion gallons of diesel and 6 billion gallons of gasoline.
Okay, and here's the energy consumption by service for installation. So 70% of consumption is for operations and 30% for installations. And here's the breakdown, roughly equal among the services for installations. So this is where all that jet fuel goes. It goes to power very thirsty aircraft that are getting, let's say, a range of 4.9 gallons per mile to 4.2 gallons per mile, according to my calculations. They're not efficient vehicles. Okay, and then here's the calculation that I've done showing U.S. Department of Defense greenhouse gas emissions.
Netta's research shows total Department of Defense carbon dioxide equivalent emissions have declined in the period 1975 to 1991. Down from about 100 million metric tons of carbon dioxide equivalent to about 60 million tons around 2011. Netta says the drop is because the U.S. closed a number of bases. Also, the military switched to more natural gas and less coal power. She estimates 1,323 million metric tons from 2001 to 2019 for the total estimate for the U.S. military. Netta Crawford's overall estimates do not include emissions from industrial production for the military, blowing up oil or gas facilities in war, and does not include concrete for reconstruction.
And I can show you at the end of this whole talk, if you're interested, how I derive these numbers. No one had ever done it, and I was really curious about the greenhouse gas footprint of the U.S. military. So I got the raw data for the period of 1975 to 2008. And then I had some other data that was provided by the Department of Energy that was more aggregated. I didn't have to do the calculations up to 2019. And here's the result. And what you'll notice is obviously that this tracks with what? It tracks with U.S. deployments. Okay, so this is a proxy. You know the United States is at war, or at either a hot war or a cold war, when emissions are up. Fuel use is up, emissions are up. And when it declines, we're in a period of either large-scale base closures or fewer exercises or both, or we're not in a hot war. And here we see the Department of Energy's way of breaking this down. They break it down in terms of standard emissions and non-standard emissions. And basically, standard emissions are those things like driving around, operating office buildings, basically non-military activities that are related to the kinetic use of force. So any uses of forces are in the non-standard emissions. The standard emissions are the sort of day-to-day activities. And then you see the total, again, for the period of 2000 to 2019. And why I'm focusing here is on this period is it's before the global war on terror began and through the wars. And what you see is an uptick, of course, in the peak of activities in 2003, 2004, and then the emissions go down over time. And they're not really significantly peaking in 2011, which is the largest deployment in Afghanistan of over 100,000 troops. They remain basically steady. And one of the questions I have is why, and I looked into that. And they're also not significantly peaking at the Iraq surge. But I'm also wanting to link this to strike sorties, because aircraft, again, are the big users of fuel. And here we see an uptick in strike sorties in 2017 through 2019 in Afghanistan. And if we go back, what we see is a slight uptick, which is actually a significant amount of greenhouse gases in the last year. And that's why it was important for me to get the most recent data, which came out this summer. We were on a steady decline, and now we're on an uptick. And that's related fairly clearly in my mind to the uptick in air strike sorties in Afghanistan in the run-up to the negotiations, the actual negotiations, and then a decline. But of course, we don't know the post-February 2020 data because the United States has stopped telling us about the number of airstrikes. Okay, so the bottom line is the U.S. military is an enormous greenhouse gas emitter. Its emissions are greater than many countries' entire emissions. And here's a handy-dandy Forbes chart based on my work, where you see we're very close to Morocco, Sweden, Peru. Portugal's another one that we're close to. Okay, so if you look at the world and find Portugal or Sweden, you can see that's roughly the size, but that also of U.S. emissions. But that also tells you that it's a very small portion relatively to the entire U.S. economy. Okay, so I've estimated the U.S. emissions in war. They're roughly, well, actually, this is my actual calculation, but they're roughly this amount. Of course, this is an estimation. So total greenhouse gas emissions for the period that I'm 2001 to 2019, about 1,323 million metric tons. And as you can see, war is only a portion of that. It's about a quarter of it. And again, we see that much of this is jet fuel emissions. But we also see at the same time, from 1975 to 2018, decreasing emissions by DoD facilities use. So when we looked at that chart earlier and we saw that greenhouse gas emissions were declining in the post 2003-2004 peak, that is post-Cold War peak, it's because we've closed many facilities and facility energy use is therefore down. And we've also changed the type of fuel that's used in the facilities so that it's less coal, more natural gas. Okay, when you have less coal, you're putting out, because coal is a great greenhouse gas emitter, you have less greenhouse gas emissions. What I haven't estimated are emissions caused by the U.S. military industry, those caused by direct targeting of petroleum, that is deliberately burning oil wells and refineries, the emissions of co-belligerents of the United States or U.S. antagonists, the significant amount of emissions caused by reconstruction, in particular, the pouring of concrete, and emissions from other... Okay, so how does the Pentagon think about fuel use and climate change? And this is the thing you probably came to hear. The DoD through 2009 knew about climate change, but they really emphasized a traditional conception of security that is immediate national security threats. And climate change is long range, not so interesting, and they didn't feel moved to really take it into account. Post-2009, there are basically three foci: operational challenges of climate change, overwhelm that's potential as the U.S. military has to respond to natural disasters, and the potential for increased conflict. There was early on in the 1990s, and here's a paper from 1990 at the Naval War College, a clear understanding of the fact that the Navy in particular would face challenges with freshwater supply and sea level rise, and they've seen it already. But in the 1997 negotiations for the Kyoto Protocol, the military was successful in keeping the calculations, the statement of emissions from the military out of each country's totals. And here we see a quote from Stuart Eisenstadt, who's acknowledging that they basically did this for security reasons. They didn't want to include U.S. military emissions in the totals. There are some emissions that can be included, but basically anything to do with war would not be included. And here we see me describing aerial attacks on ISIS oil infrastructure and assets. And what you see, what you would see, is the United States, when it in 2014 began to attack ISIS infrastructure, did so only on a small scale, and it's only about 1% of the strikes in 2014 and 2015. And then it jumps up in 2016 to about 12% of the strikes have impacts and destroy or damage ISIS oil infrastructure. In other words, it becomes increasingly important to attack oil infrastructure. So that's a traditional understanding of the role of oil and fuel in war. The other way the U.S. military thinks about it is in terms of operational vulnerability of itself. And here we see the literal tether of fuel. And of course, as Mattis says, we want to cut the military, we want to cut the tether. There's also vulnerability through attacks on supply lines. And we saw at the peak of the United States military activities and force size in Afghanistan, many attacks, hundreds of attacks on NATO supply convoys. Often that entailed blowing up fuel as it was being transited from Pakistan into Afghanistan. So they want to reduce that operational vulnerability, and the period between 2008 to the basically the present, the United States, in particular the Marines, have focused on greening themselves. They want to be lean, green fighting machines. So they've invested in solar and efficiency. And it's actually yielded very small results in terms of overall reductions, but all of those reductions, I would say most of those reductions are concentrated in operational areas. So better batteries, more solar, using lighter materials to increase efficiency and so on. Then there's the part of the DoD that focuses on climate change. And basically for them, the sky is falling. It really is. The issue is that facilities are more vulnerable. And here we see Ofut Air Force Base, which is flooded. They're concerned about a lot of bases. And here's all the assets that they've identified as vulnerable to the effects of climate change, either increased heat, drought, or flooding. Here's some images from Newport Naval Station. They're concerned about having to actually retreat from some of these locations, and adaptation may not be enough. But the other thing that they're interested in is understanding climate change caused instability. And that is, first of all, probably for them, migration. Secondly, responding to crisis. Thirdly, possible war, up to and including nuclear war. And in fact, when Admiral Samuel Locklear raised the importance of climate change, he was, as a potential conflict instability multiplier, he was criticized in the Congress by the folks who wanted to deny climate change. Okay, so the Obama administration was all over this. They said it was urgent and growing. Mattis was very concerned about climate change affecting operations. The Trump administration pulled climate change out of the national security strategy as a threat. And then Congress wrote to Trump and said, no, you have to put it back in. We need to take it seriously. So this is part of a pattern of securitizing climate change, saying that it will lead to necessarily increased risk and likelihood of conflict escalating into war. So the theory basically is that climate puts stress on people, causing migration, for example, or a conflict over resources such as water that will, and maybe food, and that will lead to greater conflict. So how is the military not thinking about climate change? Well, first of all, they're not thinking about their contribution, which is, as I've said, hasn't been calculated very well until quite recently, one calculation by me and one by this trio, Oliver Belcher, Patrick Bigger, Ben Niemark, and Kara Kennedy, actually not a trio. The idea here is that war causes climate change and climate change causes war. Now we've got two parts of the cycle. It's recursive, and that's a problem. Okay, they're also not rethinking their global footprint. And the little chart on the bottom there shows how actually the United States is much less dependent in the last 20 years on oil from the Persian Gulf. Yet many assets from, you know, boots on the ground to folks in aircraft carriers and the associated surface ships are located in or on their way to and coming back from the Persian Gulf. And this has been a traditional mission of the United States military from the days of the Rapid Deployment Force through its present incarnation in Central Command that the United States should protect access to oil, easy flow, cheap oil. It's not as important for the U.S. It is important for U.S. allies. They're also not thinking so much about the entire global footprint and the ways that U.S. needs, like the coaling stations, or sort of to have access to fuel, are increasing the fuel needs of the military, not so much on their radar. So they are, as I said, attacking oil fields, and they are, I think, recognizing the problems there with long fires. But that's in terms of decreasing potential, or actually decreasing the access and the price, increasing the price of oil. Just to sum it all up, the United States has been, like most militaries in the world, incredibly dependent on fuel to get around. That fuel use has changed not only with the types of fuel being used and dependencies on fuel, the needs for the United States to have bases all over the world, or now decreased probably needs to have those bases, but it's also changed the global climate. And if the United States wants to put two and two together, thinking about how its fuel use and greenhouse gas emissions are increasing the threats that they most fear, then I think we could see some significant change in both the patterns of U.S. fuel consumption for the military and the amount. And that could have salutary effects on the world. So I will stop there.
That was Netta Crawford, professor of political science at Boston University, on her research on the scale of the Pentagon's greenhouse gas emissions. That was before Ukraine, Gaza, and Iran. The seminar in Boston was October 14th, 2020. You would never know how dire our situation is just by the mainstream media. Right-wing billionaires own most of it, and climate reporting is no longer welcome. There is a journalist support group called Covering Climate Now. I attended their online seminar on March 5th. The host was journalist, author, and Radio EcoShock guest Mark Hertzgard. We hear a short presentation by Giles Trendle, former manager of Al Jazeera English. He knows both climate and the Middle East well.
Some background: Covering Climate Now is a global collaboration of more than 600 news outlets and thousands of journalists around the world. We're organized by journalists, for journalists, to help all journalists do a better job of covering the defining story of our time. I'm Mark Hertzgard. I'm the executive director and a co-founder of Covering Climate Now. And today's topic is the Iran war and the climate emergency.
Thanks, Mark. Yeah, I spent 19 years in Qatar, eight years as managing director of Al Jazeera English. So war and climate, as you mentioned, they're inextricably linked. Firstly, it's the greenhouse gas emissions coming from the war machine, the military machines, the jets, the tanks, the warships, just the whole military machine, plus the support systems of the military machine. Then you have the destruction of could be land, agricultural land, farmland, the biodiversity loss, the loss of carbon sinks. Then the toxic pollutions that come from the destruction, and the report by the Conflict and Environment Observatory, which Rohan mentioned, talks about the different types of hazardous material that can be released into the atmosphere from the destruction of infrastructure, the oil facilities, the military naval bases, the military bases on site. Of course, Iran has nuclear facilities. I don't know if they're weapons, but they're certainly, as they say, civilian nuclear facilities. And so destroying these can release toxins and hazardous material that are greenhouse gases. And then, of course, there's the issue of reconstruction. Once the guns fall silent, the carbon cost is still there. If and when the fighting stops, the reconstruction has a very high carbon cost. So we're looking at very difficult times. You mentioned the Strait of Hormuz. It's the map that Rohan showed, the intensity of all the different regional aspect of this. And Mark, you mentioned the Russia-Ukraine war and the emissions, the military emissions. If I can just give some figures. So in the 4 years, there's researchers found that in the 4 years, so February 2022 to February 2026, there were 312 million tons of carbon dioxide equivalent. Carbon dioxide equivalent is the measurement by which we measure greenhouse gases. So a huge amount. Now in Gaza, there was other research, which The Guardian mentioned, and I think Nina might have been involved in this, but in the first 4 months of the Gaza conflict, there were 652,000 metric tons of carbon dioxide equivalent. Now, if you extrapolate those down into monthly averages, so in the Ukraine war, 6.5 million tons of carbon dioxide per month during the war, and in Gaza, 163,000 tons per month. Now, there's a lot more carbon dioxide emissions coming during the Ukraine and Russia war, but if you take the land size, Gaza being very small, Ukraine is 1,600 times larger than Gaza. And if you extrapolate those monthly averages by the land mass, then the number of carbon dioxide emissions from military onslaught is 41 times greater in Gaza than it is in Ukraine. So that gives an idea. There's more in Ukraine, but the intensity in Gaza is interesting. So that's not meant to diminish the terrible tragedy in the emissions in Ukraine, but it does show we just need different calculations here. But emissions are a big problem, and emissions don't know any border. Climate change, climate emergency doesn't know any border. So these are going to spread across the region, in Israel and the Arab world and in the Gulf. So it's not, you know, the map that Rowan showed, those emissions are going to be everywhere. And of course, my final point, it's the same military that was pounding Gaza is now pounding Iran, plus the US military, the largest emitter of military emissions in the world. So I dread to think what sort of statistics we're going to be talking about.
And, you know, correct me if I'm wrong on this. I am not in the region, but I've read some reporting coming from investment analysts and business types who talk about how yesterday or the day before, Qatar made what sounds like a pretty bombshell announcement that it is shutting down its processing facilities for liquefied natural gas, LNG, for fear of military damages. That would seem to be very big news for Asia, because that's where most of that LNG had previously been going. A lot of, you know, China and Japan in particular are very dependent on LNG. And one of these analysts said that unlike oil shipments, which you can, you know, as soon as the guns stop, if they stop, God willing, you know, those can continue or resume, I should say. LNG doesn't work like that. It requires at least 4 to 6 weeks to get that facility of LNG back up online. And that is you're talking about really the potential for sky high energy prices, destabilized economies, et cetera, et cetera. Is that, can you shed any light on if that is a real concern and what's happening there?
Yeah, it's a huge concern. And I would say not just for Asia, but for Europe, because Europe takes a lot of its gas, LNG gas from Qatar. So this is a story not just about oil, but possibly even more so about gas and the consequences that it could have in Asia and Europe. So on the first day of the war, I went to fill my car up with petrol or gasoline, because I think we're going to see huge surges in prices. We're already seeing the price surge in oil already. But if this carries on, then we're going to see major implications for the prices, not just of oil and gas, but all the derivatives from it. And that Strait of Hormuz, yes, it's its narrowest point is 33 kilometers wide, which is nothing in when you're talking about these big tankers and ships, and you need the ships to transport the LNG. So it is a huge issue that Qatar shut down their LNG production.
And with that, this is Mark Hertzgard for Covering Climate Now, wishing you all a very pleasant day.
That was Mark Hertzgard from Covering Climate Now with media manager Giles Trendle, recorded by Alex Smith, March 5th, 2026. Find links to more in my show blog at ecoshock.org, and by all means, check out coveringclimatenow.org.
Radio EcoShock.
The Department of Defense cannot account for where its huge budget goes. They fail multiple audits every year. And they cannot track their own greenhouse gas emissions. And of course, even if they tried to do that now, that would get a person fired. It's not just a military secret. The whole operation is so vast and complex, it's really hard to tell how much climate damage the U.S. military-industrial complex does in times of peace and in times of war. Basically, the plot of Department of Defense emissions greatly depends on whether air power is being used. Whether in Afghanistan or now in Iran, whenever there are a lot of aircraft on the move, CO2 emissions go up. We know this from the history assembled by Crawford, that the massive use of aircraft sorties bombing Iran creates an equally massive amount of new emissions. They go up into the atmosphere, changing the climate for all foreseeable generations. We know that from past data, but now, this new burst of military emissions arrives just as emissions and temperatures and the rate of climate change all hit record highs. The present is blowing up the future. It does not have to be this way. We knew this way back. The Temptations sang it out in 1970 with their hit, War. I'm Alex. Thank you for listening and caring about this world.
Innocent lives. War means tears in thousands of mothers' eyes. When their sons go off the fight and lose their life, I said,
war. What is it good for?
Absolutely. Say it again.
War. What is it good for?
Absolutely.
War.
It's nothing but a heartbreak. To all mankind, the thought of war blows my mind. War has caused unrest within the younger generation. Induction, then destruction. Who wants to die?